host, Leah Sarah Pierre, and welcome to my podcast, Pierre Med. I'm a Canadian medical student, human rights, global health, and social justice advocate, as well as just an ordinary human being. As of March 24th, 2021, the Pierre Med podcast is an initiative affiliated with the Pierre Med Foundation, an organization started and inspired by the very beginnings of these conversations. Pierre Med's mission is serving humanity, connecting people, stories, and places. It is a platform that gives a voice to the voiceless, an ear to the helpless, and seeks to empower youth, physicians, and leaders far and wide. On today's episode, I have the pleasure of speaking to Che Brown, one of the co-founders of a non-profit organization in the United Kingdom, TransActual. Che Brown is an advocate for trans people, and on this episode, he will be sharing his insight into how health professionals can provide effective, inclusive, comprehensive care for trans patients, and how we, as a society, can ensure safe spaces for trans people everywhere. Why is it that health professionals feel ill-equipped and prepared to serve trans patients? Why is inclusive language so important? And why are trans patients still afraid of seeking care in the clinic and beyond? If you have answered yes to any of those questions, listen as I dive into discussion with TransActual co-founder Che Brown and how he is tackling this very problem. Che Brown co-founded TransActual in 2017 as a response to a notable rise in transphobia in the United Kingdom. TransActual works to advocate for trans people in healthcare, policy, and law, to empower trans people to self-advocate, and to educate trans people and the wider community. How would you define trans healthcare and what does it consist of?
I think when I think of trans healthcare, I think of it in two respects. So we've got transition related care, which is what clinicians often think of when they think of trans healthcare, but also general healthcare. So, you know, the type of healthcare that any member of the population might need to access. So transition related care, we've got things like counselling, access to hormones and surgery, if the person wants them, things like access to speech therapy as well, peer support. But then, of course, just like anyone else, trans people have got as wide a range of healthcare needs as you can imagine. Sometimes being trans makes some of our healthcare needs subtly different. But the number one thing for clinicians to remember is that just because someone's trans, it's not automatically relevant. So if I come to see you and I've got a sprained ankle, you don't need to ask me about my transition.
My next question is, how can providers and clinicians ensure that trans patients feel safe, empowered, and confident in the care that they receive?
I mean, I think the first important thing to do, which is, you know, it's at the heart of patient-centered care anyway, is listening to your patient. So listen to what your trans patients are telling you and what they're asking you. You know, being patient-centered, be aware though that trans people's needs will sometimes differ slightly. So for example, with cancer screening, but you know, basic things like use the name a trans person has asked you to. If you get it wrong, apologize, move on. Don't need to buy them flowers and chocolates. Just, you know, they want to forget about it as much as you do. Use the title someone's asked you to, their pronouns. With computer systems and forms, make sure that they can accommodate non-binary people. So that's people that don't identify with male or female. Or may have a more complex identification than simply being a man or a woman. So have the option for people to record their gender accurately if they're not male and they're not female, have the option of MUX as a title. Because first of all, by having these options, you're accommodating non-binary people, which is a must, but also to trans people that aren't non-binary, you're also signaling to them that this is going to be a service that's aware of trans people's needs. Because even though I, as a trans man, don't need the option of MUX on a form, if I know that you're thinking about non-binary people, I know you've probably thought about me too.
Absolutely.
And yeah, and I think at the moment, what we've got is an issue where lots of clinicians are just lacking in confidence because there's not that initial training, you know, as part of the professional curriculum in trans inclusive care. And, you know, unless you're sort of, you know, setting dosages and things like that, you don't need to be an expert in hormone treatment. You just need to know how to meet trans people's basic needs, and you need to perhaps know where to signpost for additional support. And, you know, ideally access training for that. And there's online training available. There's loads of guidance available. But even if you've not had the training, it shouldn't stop you from sort of making the efforts. So, you know, on the Transactual website, there's information for clinicians. We've just redone the website, and there's a section specifically for healthcare professionals where you can read up on trans inclusive care. You can see, if you're based in the UK, you can see what the UK based professional bodies recommend and what their policies are, and you can take a look at research papers, take a look at all sorts of guidance documents. So there's lots you can do even if you don't have access to a training course.
How can we reduce the trust gap that there is between trans patients and providers?
That's a really tricky one. And sort of Transactual, we did a big community voice survey at the start of 2021, and we spoke to more than 700 UK-based trans people. And whilst a lot of people had had good experiences with healthcare, I am sad to say that trans people reported facing racism, accessing healthcare, ableism. A lot of non-binary people experienced discrimination on the basis of being non-binary. And that's in transition-related care as well as in more general healthcare. And then, of course, in more general healthcare, some trans people experience transphobia, and that does, you know, create barriers to accessing healthcare. And, you know, some people told us that they did avoid seeking healthcare. So things that you can do to reduce barriers is, you know, finding ways to signal, you know, non-verbally that your service is trans inclusive and you've thought about trans people's needs. So like I said, it could be making your forms non-binary inclusive. It could be that in your waiting room, you've got literature that's targeted towards trans people. So if you're a sexual health clinic, for example, there's literature available targeted towards trans people, because whilst broadly, you know, it's all roughly the same, actually, you know, it needs framing in a different way. Or, you know, if you're a clinic that is deals with prostate cancer, for example, you might make sure that in your waiting room you've got a poster up that shows a trans woman, because trans women, you know, do also need to access prostate cancer screening and could potentially get prostate cancer. So it's little signals like that, making sure that you don't make assumptions. So, and this goes for, you know, admin staff, reception staff as well, you know, knowing that don't make an assumption based on whether someone's got a deep voice or not. That's a sort of common thing that makes people nervous, is making a phone call. So for me, I get nervous that someone might think I'm a woman, when I'm a man. But for some trans women, they get they might get mistaken for a man and called sir on the phone, and that sort of adds additional barriers and would prevent them from phoning up in the future. So it's lots of little, quite subtle things, but I'd say, you know, visibility and silent signals, but also, you know, avoid making assumptions.
What are some good versus bad patient experiences accessing healthcare?
So at Transactual, we hear about a really wide range of experiences. Some terrible, some great. So, you know, examples of bad experiences, people whose doctor refused to refer them to a gender identity clinic. We hear lots of reasons why that happens. Sometimes it's because someone has a disability or someone is autistic, so that ableism comes into play. General practice surgeries refusing to change someone's sex or name on the medical records and going against the national guidance. We've heard stories of trans people that have been on hormones for years and they've moved to a different GP, so general practitioner, and they've refused to continue the prescription. It's particularly an issue if people move from overseas into the UK, and I would imagine it's the same in other countries too. Lots of things like that. I've been hearing stories of, trans men requesting hysterectomies because of endometriosis or cysts or things that are causing pain, and the gynecologist refusing the referral because they're a trans man. And obviously that's direct discrimination, and the reasoning is often given, oh, well, he's going to access lower surgery anyway and there'll be a hysterectomy then. But actually in the UK there's currently there's no NHS provision for lower surgery for trans men. There was an issue with the contract, and since we became aware of it in April this year, and it's now September, and there's no NHS provision, and it's not in the UK because we have access to the NHS, which we're lucky to access free healthcare. At the same time, it means that if we had health insurance, it wouldn't cover it either, because there's the assumption we can get it on the NHS. So we've got, you know, people waiting in pain for a long time as well. But on a plus side, I can share a really positive personal experience that I've had. So I'm a trans man. I've not had a hysterectomy yet. And when I went to sexual health clinic for a regular checkup, it's one I feel comfortable going to because they deal with quite a large LGBT population. It's in the centre of London. And the person that was taking my bloods also worked at the specific clinic that sexual health centre runs. And she said to me, when was the last time you had a cervical cancer smear? When were you last screened? We're doing some trans-specific clinics. Can I phone you next week to book an appointment? And she did phone me the next week. And I'd been putting it off for years because there's just, you know, a lot of barriers there. And, you know, being able to go to the trans-specific clinic, I knew that they understood my needs. She was very thoughtful. She understood that it'd be, you know, a lot of people find going for cervical cancer screening difficult, but when you're a trans man and you feel like perhaps I shouldn't have these body parts in the first place, it's even worse. But because they were so caring and thoughtful, it made it a lot easier for me. And then I did have an issue. I had precancerous changes, but when they phoned me to talk about it, they told me all about the gynae department I was going to be referred to. They reassured me that, you know, they're good, and experienced with trans men and with non-binary people. And they gave me that bit of reassurance because, again, going into an appointment at a department that's specific, that's, you know, stereotypically for women, it's sort of quite challenging and sort of, oh no, like, are they going to treat me as if I'm a woman? Are they going to misgender me? All of that. Downside was I did get sent a leaflet that was entitled Information for Women attending the department. And obviously what we want to see is, you know, literature that uses inclusive language. And that's not necessarily using, like, losing the word woman or women completely from literature. It could just be women and trans people, or, you know, women and anyone else with a uterus or a cervix. And, you know, I did feel a bit uncomfortable in the waiting room, and I saw a member of staff sort of look at me, and obviously this is during, or not obviously, but this was during the height of the COVID pandemic, you know, although it's far from past yet. So they were keeping, you know, people in the hospital to a minimum anyway. And I sort of saw a member of staff having a word with reception saying, what's that man doing there? But apart from that, you know, once I got into the consultation, the consultant made it really clear that she treated trans guys before, but she did it like not in a weird way. She didn't just come out and say, oh, I've treated lots of trans men. She just, you know, just through the questions, what would make you comfortable? Other trans men have asked for this, you know? And then sort of based on the examination, the consultant was really proactive. So she said, oh, right, so I know that you're on the waiting list for your next stage of phalloplasty that involves a hysterectomy. Do you want me to liaise with your surgical provider? So is that sort of being proactive, and those sort of small cues, and the sort of knowing that she understood as well how testosterone would have changed my anatomy, you know, didn't blink at the fact that I'm between stages one and two of phalloplasty, which means your genitalia are not sort of the typical that a gynecologist would see. She didn't bat an eyelid, and I think that's, you know, that's an example of a sort of you know, really good practice, because even if she did think sort of inside, I've never treated a patient that's sort of started phalloplasty before, she didn't show it, and that was really important.
I love how you highlighted those two experiences, Shane, to show us how what is good patient care and what is bad patient care. And I think this is extremely useful for care providers. But going into the next question, which you sort of touched on, is how do we make our environments and our practices more inclusive?
You know, does your literature use inclusive language? Do your forms use inclusive language? I've got a friend that he's a trans man. And when he was pregnant, he was having, he had forms to fill out from the midwife. And, you know, all down the form, it was like name of mum, language of she, her. And he just, you know, like, I think he went through and crossed it all out and put dad's, and he and him. But it's, you know, making that language inclusive. And like I said, it's not about never using she and her, never using the word mum. Of course we're gonna use those words, and where they're appropriate, it's just recognizing your language to be inclusive. You also need to acknowledge, if, you know, if it's to do with pregnancy, you need to acknowledge the existence of trans men and non-binary people that might want to give birth. And again, if it's for something like prostate care, acknowledging that trans women have a prostate, so using that inclusive language. And also, you know, if it's something that's not traditionally gendered, have we used gendered language for no reason? Have we used he slash her or his slash hers when we could have just used theirs, you know? I've mentioned about, non-binary inclusive forms, trans-specific literature, not making assumptions. And I guess, understand that most of the time our health needs are the same as anyone else's. It's just sometimes we need adjustments to make us comfortable. And if you're not sure about what adjustments we might want, just ask, is there anything that I could do to make your experience more comfortable? If in doubt, ask, but only ask things that are relevant.
I love that you highlighted all those important points of how we can make our practices inclusive, because there's no doubt that if our practices are inclusive, patients will feel more comfortable and trust the provider more, seeing that the environment is already made friendly for them. So Jay, why don't you tell us now about some traditional gendered healthcare fields and how we should care for trans patients. And the first one I have for you is gynecology for trans men and non-binary patients.
Yeah, so it's, like I'd said about using inclusive language, have literature relevant to trans men and non-binary people. So, in a gynecology department, think about how it would feel to be a trans man and all of the posters have got women on, when actually could you find a poster that's got a trans man or a non-binary person on to sort of, show the inclusive, beware of the additional barriers, sort of beware of, so you get gynecology is somewhere where sort of our hormone treatment is relevant, because it's, being aware that vaginal walls are thinner as a result of testosterone treatment quite often. So, being aware of that and being aware that in those sorts of situations, we're going to face additional barriers. We might need extra support. We might need a supportive friend with us, because it's for a lot of us, it's challenging. And for a lot of us, we might feel like really anxious about it.
Okay, what about health maintenance for trans people? Are there any examinations or preventative services that they must continue to undergo just as any other person would?
Yeah, so the best way to think about it is think about what body parts someone has. So the one thing is, trans women retain their prostate. So remembering that trans women over 50 should be checked. Remembering that, as we know that people of any gender can get breast cancer regardless of them being trans or not. Realizing that, trans women obviously, once they're at the age where they need to access screening, then if they've developed breasts, then they should be accessing mammograms, and the same for non-binary people with breasts, but also recognizing that if a trans man or a non-binary person that develop breasts as a result of going through puberty, if they've not had an mastectomy, then it's important that if they're over 40, that they also get screened. But understanding that depending on their relationship with their body, it might be sort of quite a sensitive thing, and a thing that there might be barriers around. Other types of screening is, like I said, if it's to do with reproductive type systems, it's, based on whatever body part someone's got. Otherwise, other types of sort of health maintenance, it's, in line what you would do for any other patient of that gender.
It's important we spoke about this, Jay, because a lot of the times healthcare professionals will not look past what they see in front of them and just completely neglect to screen for cervical or prostate, or even offer immunizations on this kind of this discrimination that gets perpetuated in the system against trans patients.
Yeah.
So then, Che, how do we make trans people feel comfortable, and what are some inappropriate questions and some appropriate questions that providers and health professionals can consider asking their patients?
Sure. First thing to ask yourself, is it relevant? So if I came to your office and said, I've been having trouble sleeping, you might want to ask, what's causing it? Does this relate to your dysphoria? Are you experiencing dysphoria? But don't assume that it is. But then, if I came to you with a dislocated shoulder, you wouldn't need to ask me anything to do with my transition because it's unrelated. So it's think first, is this relevant? So, if you're dealing with nose and throat, you don't need to know about my genitals, for example. However, if you're looking at blood test results and I'm on testosterone treatment, it might be relevant. So really, really think it through. Certain comments that are, often said in a sort of the most kind-hearted of way, again, without really thinking. So, if someone's struggling and, maybe it's a trans woman and she says, I'm really struggling with depression at the moment, and in part it's caused by, people referring to me as Mr. or Sir in a shop. It's not a good thing to say, oh, have you thought about wearing more makeup? So avoiding things that comment on appearance. I recently had a doctor tell me I was very convincing. And I did want to ask what he was trying to be convinced of. Because again, those comments are often sort of well-meaning, but based on, first of all, they're based on an idea of what men and women should look like. And that an idea that trans people have to look like cisgender people. And while some trans people do want to look indistinguishable from cisgender people, other trans people don't mind it. And it's not for anyone to enforce those ideas. So again, just it's about thinking before you speak. And thinking, what is the motivation behind what I'm saying or what I'm asking? Is it because I'm curious, or is it because I need to know?
Thinking before you speak, Che, because even in North America, we've seen providers pass hurtful remarks or say things to offend patients, and it's really traumatized so many patients that they've not wanted to go back and access or seek care, and that just makes the trust gap and even larger, because now you have so many in the population that are just afraid of going to the clinic.
Yeah, so, exactly.
And so this is something that needs to change. Providers need to be more conscious and aware of what they say and how what they say can actually affect the patient long beyond the time that they leave the clinic. So what advice do you have for parents of trans youth who want to seek hormone therapy?
So I think the most important thing is to listen to them. Keep an open mind, listen to them. Parents of trans people, no matter how old their child is when they come out, whether they're 5 or 50, there's often an adjustment period. That's okay, but show them that you support them. In the UK, access to hormone therapy for trans youth involves lots of sort of jumping through hoops and lots of checks, balances, additional jumping through hoops, and lots of waiting. So parents based in the UK, there is a very long waiting list for the only sort of gender clinic on the NHS. So the best thing to do is to get a referral in, and then, you know, it might be by the time you get to the top of the waiting list, your child still wants to access hormone therapy. It might be they don't. If they don't, they just come off the waiting list. So, you know, it's sort of talking to them about, look, I value you for who you are. I'm going to support you for who you are. No journey is ever the same. No two trans people's journey is ever the same. And in fact, no two cisgender people's journey or relationship with their gender is the same either. So, you know, affirming them and also letting them know that their relationship with their body might change and it might not. In the UK, trans young people can only access cross-sex hormones from the age of 16, and there's a lot sort of going on legally and policy-wise at the moment like that, because there's sort of misplaced controversy about it. What tends to happen is when they get to the top of the very long waiting list, after many, many consultations, they might be given puberty blockers. And so those are given from, I believe it's Tanner stage 2, might be Tanner stage 3. So don't quote me on the Tanner stage, but it's they're only given once puberty has begun. And there's a real myth about puberty blockers, actually. There's lots of misconceptions that, oh, they're experimental, there's no evidence base. And that's not true at all. There's longitudinal studies in use of puberty blockers. There is an evidence base. They're not experimental. They're used off-label, just as lots of medicines and drugs for under 18s are used off-label because of, you know, ethics of medical clinical trials on under 18s. But look for the evidence base. If you're a clinician, look for the evidence base. It is there. But for parents, sort of know that your child isn't necessarily going to find it easy to access hormones or to access blockers, but to be there biggest champion and just to support them in any way you can.
And for my last question that I have for you, Che, I'd like for you to break it down into the patient level, the provider level, and then the community level. So how do we push for consistent and equitable access to comprehensive trans and gender affirming healthcare in our community and even healthcare coverage?
For me and for Transactual, what we want to see is all people being able to access a gender-affirming model of care based on informed consent. And that, whilst it's available in some parts of the world, it's, you know, definitely not available in the UK, and there's quite an archaic system. So in terms of community members, it's, you know, writing to the policymakers, you know, so in the UK, it's writing to your Member of Parliament or Member of Scottish Parliament or Welsh Senedd member, or, you know, in the States, write to your senator, write to your governor. Talk about what the issues are. Talk about, if you're trans, talk about how it impacts you. If you're not trans, talk about how it impacts people you know, sort of difficulties that people have accessing transition-related care. Seek to, if you're not trans, maybe if you're a clinician, use your privilege to advocate for trans people. So listen to what trans people are saying, you know, follow trans people on social media, listen to trans people's podcasts. There are some great ones. Center trans people's voices, but use your privilege and your position to advocate for trans people. So do you sit on a diversity and inclusion board within your service? Could you? Have you spotted something in your service that's not trans inclusive? Could you do something about it? Could you talk to your medical school about providing training on trans inclusion? Or, those sorts of things. And I think some key components for equitable access to healthcare, for whether you're an individual member of the community, whether you're a clinician, it's remembering that trans inclusive healthcare is also healthcare that is anti-racist. It's also healthcare that is inclusive of disabled people. It's anti-sexist, because it's inclusive of sex workers, because all of trans people would fit into all of those categories, and people from those categories would, also be trans. And so it's important to recognize, remembering, trans people can be elderly, trans people can be young, all of those things. And also that everybody needs to be able to access healthcare, and affordability should never be an issue either.
Yes, Shay, healthcare is a human right, and
It is.
you went into such beautiful detail into what each level of the community can do, from providers to patients to community makers. And I said that was the last question, but I want you to highlight some trans people's podcasts for listeners to go listen to. So if you don't mind giving us a few.
Oh, okay. If you want to hear about trans history, you want to listen to One from the Vaults. If you want to hear about trans people's everyday experiences and the issues that are impacting trans people, and especially trans people of colour, you want to be listening to Marsha's Plate. If you want to know about trans people's experiences in the UK, listen to What the Trans. And there's so many more. Those are just the three that popped off my head, but there are loads more. Get looking, and be looking on the Trans Actual website as well for sort of recommendations for podcasts, and recommended reading and articles as well.
I just want to thank you so much, Hey, for coming onto the PureMed podcast, for sharing your views, your opinions, for providing such an informative and educational session about inclusive care for trans patients. And I want to thank you from the entire team so much for the work that you do every day. Keep doing it. It's never easy to be an advocate to push for change, but it's dedicated individuals such as yourself that are really changing the way that people, trans people, and patients access care.
Thanks ever so much for having me.
Thank you for listening to the PureMed podcast. It means the world to have a supportive audience from 50 plus countries and counting. If you've enjoyed this episode, don't forget to subscribe to stay updated. Feel free to share it with friends and family members, and more importantly, please check out Trans Actual UK. The platform offers health professionals and students a non-judgmental and inclusive space to learn, ask questions, and to allow them to connect with other trans and LGBTQ plus allies. For further information, follow us on social media or email us at puremedfoundation@gmail.com. We here at PureMed are excited to bring you new content, stories, and conversations week in and week out. We cannot wait to see our new and familiar faces here back each episode. Thank you for tuning in. Stay safe, stay healthy.